Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Steven Siegel about his book, Mapmen, Transnational Lives and Deaths of Geographers in the Making of East Central Europe, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2018. Steven Siegel is professor of history at the University of Northern Colorado. He is the author of Mapping Europe's Borderlands, Russian Cartography in the Age of Empire, and Ukraine Under Western Eyes. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, nice to join you today.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
So, speaking about Mapmen, Transnational Lives and Deaths of Geographers in the Making of East Central Europe, I have a question about the name of the book, and you were probably asked this question numerous times. At first glance, the phrase mapmen appears as one word, at least according to the design of the book. But the design of the book also makes it very clear to read the phrase as consisting of two distinct words. Map is in red and men is in black. So you do provide your definition of mapmen in the introductory part. But why is it this is so significant to underline some borderline between maps and man, and to combine these words at the same time? So I'm also curious about transnational lives and deaths. It can be read as transnational, taking into consideration the material that you cover, but it can also be read as something on an existential and ideological levels.
So both of these are excellent questions. I have to begin by crediting my design and layout team at the University of Chicago Press. There were a couple of aesthetic ideas that I was hoping for with the book's design. And one is just brazen imitation of Matt Weiner's Mad Men, the series that everyone watches on Netflix. And so one can actually see Mad Men and Mapmen coming together on the cover in a very suggestive and hopefully persuasive and subconscious way. The photo on the cover of the book was a photo of men who were redrawing Europe. This was from the National Geographic. And the other part to your question is about the transnational lives and deaths. So one of my central aims in the book, and we can talk about this, is really to capture the emotional lives of individuals who were drawing maps. And so it's not just human geography in a kind of abstract or conceptual way. It's the moods that people who were part of a certain generation had. And that generation stretches quite widely in Central and Eastern Europe from, I would say, the 1850s or 1860s up through several generations in Germany, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia, Slovakia, Ukraine, maybe into the 1950s and, in fact, well beyond. The transnational aspect of this is my own search, since I worked on this book for the better part of 6 years, for the personal bonds, the bonds of power, the bonds of knowledge, the expertise that united a certain generation at a particular moment in time in these countries of Central and Eastern Europe.
So would you tell a little bit about how you collected the data? Where did you travel and what archives did you use and where you worked? What personal maps probably you also made while working on this project? You just mentioned that you worked for 6 years on this book.
Yeah, I really started this project in 2010, and it was almost as if by accident. I found myself in Baltimore. I was a great fan of The Wire, and I had always wanted to spend some time at Johns Hopkins doing research. And one of the funny things that I found at Johns Hopkins University in their special collections was the archive for one of their former presidents, mm-hmm. Isaiah Bowman. And Isaiah Bowman left some very bizarre instructions, as I later found out, about people doing research in his archive, his personal papers. He demanded, I found out from librarians and archivists and later from people who knew the family, that only a person of international standing who is a man who is 35 years old could have access to all of his dirty laundry, have access to his papers. Now, of course, that prompted my curiosity. Well, how can, you know, what is he actually trying to cover up? So that led me back to read a great biography, which won the American Association of American Geographers Prize in 2004 by the late Scottish geographer Neil Smith, who was a student of David Harvey. And that's the American angle, because Bowman, after all, was appointed as the chief territorial specialist for President Wilson. He had all of these international contacts with Polish, Hungarian, German, French, and many other geographers. So to answer your question about archives, I used fewer archives in fewer countries than I did in Mapping Europe's Borderlands. Mm-hmm. There were 11 languages and 24 archives in Mapping Europe's Borderlands, which was my dissertation and my first book. This one posed an enormous challenge. I think the biggest challenge of which was learning Hungarian from scratch. I have no family background in Hungarian. I did not speak Magyarul. I was someone who studied Polish and Italian, and I knew German languages, Germanic languages. So I began really taking a deep interest in Hungary. And although there are many parts of the book which took me to Leipzig, Budapest, Krakow, I interviewed Romer's great-granddaughter in Wrocław, in the old town. I ended up in Lviv, searching for the family of Rudnitsky, and I found some amazing things. Anyway, there are fewer archives and I think fewer languages, but this still was a six-year project, and I came into it in all kinds of uncanny and unexpected ways. I'd call it a Hungarian book. It's actually in many ways a Hungarian book, which started with Orban and the 2000 teens and the turn toward illiberalism. And eventually, when I was finishing up my research after Maidan, I was in Ukraine in the early part of 2015. So that's a significant part of the book.
Well, that's actually quite inspiring to learn a language in order to complete a project. How did you handle that challenge? Did you take a class or did you just learn the language on its own? But from what I heard, Hungarian is considered to be one of the most difficult, challenging languages to learn. But I don't have any experience with Hungarian.
Well, Natalia, since you're interviewing me from Indiana University, Bloomington, I owe a great deal of thanks to IU Bloomington and my magnificent Hungarian teacher, Valeria Varga.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I just want to give a shout out to her and to the Swissel program, the program in summer study for East European Eurasian languages. It was an incredible experience learning Hungarian with her. I don't know if I was her best student, probably not. But, you know, I started, as many Americans did who took an interest in Russia and Eastern Europe in the late 90s and even before, going through these intensive language programs. Mm-hmm. And I actually studied Russian at Indiana in 1998, you can imagine that, in a former century. And so I studied Hungarian more formally. I really needed the grammatical training in order to be able to read letters, and especially to work through correspondence. Mm-hmm. I worked through Teleki's very famous suicide note from August 3rd of 1941, when the prime minister of the country, Teleki, Count Paul Teleki, committed suicide. And without that language knowledge, I really couldn't have done the archival research that I did for this book.
That's amazing. So in your book, you focus primarily on Germany, Poland, Hungary, and Ukraine. And the interest to these locations, so to speak, stem from your interest in Russia first. Did I understand that correctly? So you were studying the Russian language, and probably your research was focused on Russia as well, as your first book is mapping Europe's borderlands, Russian cartography in the age of empire. And then little by little, you developed your interest in other places.
Yeah, I think in terms of the development of the book and all of the chapters, I would not call it a Russian book. My first Slavic language was actually Polish. Mm-hmm. And I studied Ukrainian after I had learned Polish. In fact, after I had studied both Russian and Czech, I became involved with the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. I took Ukrainian for the first time formally in 2000. Mm-hmm. And one of the wonderful things that happened to me in the decade of the noughties was being commissioned by the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute to write Ukraine Under Western Eyes. And that particular book got me really more deeply interested in the history of Ukrainian geography and cartography. My major Ukrainian figure is Stepan Rudnitsky. There are, of course, other Ukrainians like Volodymyr Kubiyovich, who was, many people forget, trained as an ethnographer and a geographer. But I wanted to combine biography and life story with the visual saturation of maps, what it is actually like or was like for people like Rudnitsky to found a national school of geography and cartography, as he tried to do for Ukraine. And we can talk about his life trajectory and some of the others, but it's not as much of a Russian book. The Russian Revolution is certainly present. Soviet policies of the 1920s, particularly vis-a-vis Ukraine, are present. And of course, Rudnitsky was a victim of Stalin's purges when he was killed en masse with other members of the humanistic and technical intelligentsia at Solovets, Solovki in 1937.
Well, I have a few questions for you about the material which is presented in the book. But first of all, I would like to ask you to describe what a map is for you, because my understanding is a map for you is not just some piece of paper that shows a territory of a country, but it's more than that. It's not a crystallized item that stays stable. It constantly evolves and changes. And I would also say that we can have a couple of versions of maps, especially today, with all these border changes, which are connected with some political turmoil.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit unusual in the way that I conceive of maps and think about maps. If there's a baseline, I think of maps as fantasies. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, there are all of the conventional things. Maps are texts. Maps are tools. Maps are part of the gadgetry of millennial fetishism. Maps enable you to get from A to B. But when I think of maps, I really do think of craftsmanship and aesthetics. So a couple of the examples I use toward the end of my book are the very famous surrealist map of the world, which was an avant-garde project showing islands in 1929 and blowing things like fixed scale and fixed proportion up, changing it to the level of fantasy and prejudice. Another good example I would give would be the avant-garde sculptor whose name is David Černý, who's a Czech sculptor who was commissioned by the EU in Brussels to create an installation of a map. And he called it not Europa, but Entropa, in which he had every country represented by something that was completely banal and kitschy and in bad taste. So, you know, Romania was a Dracula-themed amusement park. Switzerland was a box of Toblerone chocolate. Italy was a football field with very muscular men masturbating on the field. And of course, this particular map, because it is a map, is still a picture and a text and a tool. It's a way to instrumentalize European integration. But it's funny, it's ironic, it's abstract, and ultimately it was too outré for Brussels. And they, in 2009, when he designed this exhibit, they tried, in fact, to take it down. So when I think of maps, I do think you do need basic things in order to make a map. You need a scale, you need a key, you need a projection, but it doesn't have to be in that formal Cartesian kind of way where you're point plotting and that's all you do. Or in GPS where you're just trying to get people from one location to the other. I really do think of maps in the sense of fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you, your book includes the stories of five geographers on MapMan, and you already mentioned a few of them. Would you briefly talk about each of them and maybe would you mention which one was the most challenging in the project?
Sure. I'll try to make this into a short question because I ended up going through all of their papers and all of their files. And for someone like the Polish geographer I study, it was 82 volumes. So my five people, the protagonists, primary men in the book are Professor Albrecht Penck. He was a professor who was born in Germany near Leipzig. He is probably most famous for being a geomorphologist and for proposing in Bern in 1981 the 1-to-1 million map of the world. This is something, of course, which becomes lampooned by writers like Umberto Eco. He was the chair of geography at what's now Humboldt University in Berlin. He was on exchange to the United States, to Columbia University before World War I. He became a longtime friend of people like Isaiah Bowman, whom he met at Harvard. And I think what's interesting about Penck as a professor is that he falls within the what Germans will call the folkish tradition of conservative and colonial geography. He supported both the Kaiser during World War I and, as it turns out, and I talk about this because it's very complicated, Hitler during World War II. So Penck, after all of the losses of the Hohenzollern Empire, the loss of colonial Germany and its outposts, was one of the primary advocates of revisionism in the German political and social system of the Weimar Republic. And he died at age 87, fleeing from, in fact, from Berlin to Prague, where he died in 1945. The second geographer is Eugeniusz Rohmer of Poland. I write about him in some of my earlier work. He was born 1871, died 1954. He survived two occupations during World War II by hiding in a monastery in Lviv for 3 years. He really was, in many respects, the founder of modern Polish geography and cartography. He was the first chair in the modern sense at the University of Lemberg, what was Jan Kazimierz, what's now Ivan Franko, in 1911. But he comes from an old, very old Szlachta family, going back to the 15th century. And I think one thing I learned from Rohmer, who was an aristocrat, rather than from Penck, who was very much a bourgeois Mandarin type of academic, was that Rohmer's mental map went back centuries, in fact, like 15 generations, stretching across all of the family's aristocratic estates from north to south. Rohmer drew a lot of the base maps for Poland. He was the go-to expert in the Polish delegation after World War I. He was the most important cartographer for the Treaty of Riga in 1921, and he was an internationalist. He actually believed in a so-called resurrected or reborn Poland, but he tried to broker friendships and in many ways perform like Paderewski performed in Paris for the Polish cause. He was very anti-Ukrainian. In fact, this was so surprising to me. In fact, even more shocking than I thought as I looked through all of his sources. The Ukrainian geographer we can talk about, his name was Stepan Rudnitsky, born in East Galicia in 1877, died, as I mentioned, a victim of the purges. There are several interesting things about Rudnitsky. He had a doctorate. He competed with Rohmer. He actually advocated a greater Ukraine in a kind of colonial and great power way. He appealed to diasporas. He worked for some time for the Union for the Liberation, I forget what it's called, the Union for the Liberation of Ukrainians in New Jersey. It was the sort of mirror image of the same organization that existed in Vienna during World War I. Anyway, he drew some of the very first maps in Ukrainian, mm-hmm. And his hero was Mykhailo Hrushevsky. Hrushevsky was one of his biggest supporters and patrons, and Hrushevsky hoped that Rudnitsky could do for geography what Hrushevsky had done for history, mm-hmm. uniting Ruthenians, Ukrainians on both sides of the Zbruch River. It didn't turn out that way. Rudnitsky ended up migrating to Kharkiv, Soviet Kharkiv, where he hoped to start a geographical institute for the technical intelligentsia. It didn't work out that way. Bowman, I mentioned, was absolutely fascinating. He was a student of William Morris Davis. He had traveled to South America. He worked for the Foreign Affairs Journal. He worked for Wilson's Inquiry. He became the president of Johns Hopkins University from 1935 to 1948 and died in Baltimore in 1950. And the last one is Count Paul Teleki. He's my Hungarian, but he's really a Transylvanian aristocrat. Born in Budapest, his history goes back at least 17 generations. He was a complete amateur. He had traveled to Africa. In fact, he had been to the Sudan. He took up a really deep interest in early modern European cartography, and particularly he was fascinated by Japan. He was a Japanophile, like in the way that H.G. Wells and sort of artists in the 19-teens were Japanophiles, although he knew no Japanese. And he became prime minister of Hungary twice, after his career as a geographer, twice prime minister, first during the regime right after World War I and after Béla Kun and the Communist Revolution, and then he was prime minister from 1939 up until his suicide in April of 1941. So I'm fascinated by these three individuals. There are others, you know. There are wives, there are daughters, there are many others that I describe who are part of their saga. But I tried to create a five-headed monster and to tell the story in the book of their lives and work.
While you were doing this research, did you come across any female characters who were main characters in creating maps?
Well, I did, and I get asked this question a lot, and I think there's more research that clearly needs to be done on it. I'll give a couple of examples. So, first, in Hungary, there were women who were part of the Hungarian Geographical Society, mm-hmm. and they were, in many ways, continuing a colonial legacy. So, the Hungarian Geographical Society starts in 1872. Older ones will include the Russian Geographical Society or the Imperial Russian Geographical Society, 1845, the Royal Geographical Society, 1830, the Berlin one, and the Paris one from the 1820s. There were plenty of women in the Hungarian Geographical Society who were explorers. In the Polish case, I found that Romer had a number of women who became involved in what was called in the 1920s school cartography and school geography. So Romer opened a cartographic firm, which was called Chonsnitsa Atlas, Princess Atlas Firm. And it was one of the largest of those types of cartographic firms in Europe, geographical and cartographic work in the 1920s within the Polish school system. And I think in the way that he conceived it, the purpose of drawing maps was to create Polonized Poles, mm-hmm. not Ukrainians, but Polonized Poles, not Germans, but Polonized Poles. And there was a kind of ethnocentrism, but it was an ethnocentrism that was premised on the idea that others, multi-ethnic others, multi-confessional others, would assimilate to a greater Poland. And so there were a number of Polish-speaking women, who Polonophone women, who ended up working with Romer, the founding of his journals, and working in the cartographic firms. The other parts of the story are really the daughters and, mm-hmm. and the granddaughters. So these were not liberal feminist men. And I think this there's really no way around this. One has to be absolutely honest about their misogyny and their racism and their colonial knowledge. This point really, I hope, does come across in the book. These were nasty beasts, many of them. Bowman had two boys. He sought to give them the most elite education possible. He was a farm boy who grew up in Ontario, as a matter of fact, and across the border to Canada. He wanted his two sons to have a premier education for them to follow in his footsteps, and eventually, as I showed, to try and become geographers, which one did. But his daughter Olive was just destined to be a housewife, as he put it. And Bowman even told his sons, and I found this in the letters, that they should marry well, and they should find a woman to travel around the world with them and like have babies. So though those men that I describe were not exactly open in any kind of professionalization way, although if you dig a little bit deeper, you can see how they began to start in the 1920s to conceive of a role for women as teachers, and especially for women as geography teachers, or for people who were working, for women who were working in cartography firms and shops.
Well, I just wanted to say that it's a real pleasure to read your book, and for many reasons. It's very rich in bibliography, very rich in historical facts, in biography facts. And of course, your writing style deserves a separate compliment. What I discovered for myself as well is that you really opened this world, as you mentioned, this fantasy of map making, where map making is not some science, but it's some occupation. It's one's passion, so to speak. And you feel actually these lines, which are incorporated in borders, which are incorporated in maps, as moving and as, well, if we could use that word, alive. So we actually feel them very fluid, in a fluid way. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking about your characters that you describe, but I was also thinking about them not only as representatives of that country for which they create maps, but also those countries that are outside those borders. In other words, I was wondering about the gaze of the outsider of their country. So could you just tell us a little bit about how they were perceived by outsiders, but those who were put behind those borders?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Natalia, and thank you for the compliment on the writing style. One of my goals is to make this book accessible and hopefully translatable into the languages and into the countries that I study. So, I have been lecturing, and if the plague is not upon us forever, I hope to continue to talk about it in Hungary and in Germany and Poland and Ukraine. I was supposed to give the 100th anniversary lecture for the Treaty of Trianon in Hungary, but to give it in Vienna for the Wiesenthal Center. And I think this is a good segue to think of the gaze that you're thinking about, because if you look at the Hungarian maps, and I'll use those as my example, clearly Hungarian geographers, especially those of a revisionist bent, who are supporting the idea that Hungary was dismembered, those revisionists in the 1920s are really trying to establish contacts with others in the diaspora and abroad, especially in North America. Don't forget, there are 3.3 million Hungarians who, as a result of this treaty in June of 1920, end up outside of the borders. So, people like to speak in cliches sometimes about how the war didn't end in 1918. Well, yes, everybody knows that. Also, the story of refugees and displacement and long-term displacement, I think, is a story that needs to be told. So what the Hungarian revisionists tried to do was to create as great a Hungary as possible. They were wedded to this idea. And in fact, Teleki himself, I found out, was wedded to the idea all the way through the first and second Vienna Awards in 1938 and 1940, while he was trying to create a kind of diplomacy between fascism and what was left of liberal democracy in the 1930s. What he really wanted to do was to make Hungary as big as possible, a greater Hungary as big as possible. And that meant regaining territory that was lost to Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia. In fact, right up until the end of his life. That was his fixed idea. The other part of your question, the gazes across borders, well, geographers lost their international community in 1914 and more deeply in the nationalist universe of 1918 and 1919. Ukraine was, under the occupation, one might say, of somewhere between 9 and 11 governments between 1917 and 1922. So what this meant for someone like Rudnitsky was that he had to create an alternative career because he could not be a professor at Jan Kazimierz in the Second Republic of Poland. He was a diaspora Ukrainian. He actually wrote, published in Czech. His family was German-speaking. He was absolutely fluent in German. He kept up his German correspondences with prominent geographers like Penck or Bruckner or Krebs. And eventually, when Rudnitsky was granted the opportunity to return, quote unquote, to Ukraine, his return was actually to a city he had never visited, but was then considered part of Ukraine. And that was in Soviet Kharkiv, Kharkiv in 1925. So these borders had absolutely changed. And I think, you know, beneath the science of Wissenschaft or the science of Nauka are some monumental changes in the lives of these individuals. One more sort of footnote to this. I like doing family history and sometimes in an old-fashioned kind of way, but it's how we get the stories. And the stories all have to be fact-checked because and it's impossible, right? It is absolutely impossible. Rudnitsky is a good example of this. There are plenty of lies and there are plenty of sort of mendacities and prevarications, but there are also myths that he actually really believed about himself. And he faced some very tumultuous years, having been displaced from a city where he thought he could make his career as Ukrainian, having lost his wife to cancer. His wife died at the age of 35. You know, these are some of the things that don't make appearances in, strictly speaking, scientific Kurzbiografien. Mm-hmm. They also really deserve a place. And I wanted to give the full kind of three-dimensional picture of the humans behind the maps.
Yeah, I have another question about additional lines, borders, whatever we call those. Your spelling choice for some locations. In your previous answer, you mentioned Kharkiv. In another answer, you also mentioned Lviv, Lvov, Lvov, Lemberg. And I believe that this spelling / spelling also adds some additional meaning to your project as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to make a choice. And when you're making a choice, you will face a charge that you're being a nationalist or a nation builder. I think in some ways it's absolutely true that I am a Ukrainian nation builder. I'm certainly engaged in Ukrainian studies and Ukrainian history. But my origin story in trying to think about Ukrainian relations is really through the lens of all of the peoples in the lands that might be considered Boplan's Ukraine. And if not Boplan's Ukraina or Ukraina, then maybe even something else. You know, even when we call Galicia Galicia, it's Galitsin or Galitsin-Volhynin. I had to make some choices, certainly, with cities like Lviv, Lvov, Lemberg, Leopold. But I think I was trying to be fair to the mentality, the mental mapping, even the psychological mapping of the individuals. And in that way, I'm less of a person who believes in discursive analysis and more of a person who believes in intent. I want to get how the person sees himself or herself through the map. And I think that's incredibly important for people who are actually using maps for both war and peace building purposes. There are many ways to kind of cast or script Rudnitsky. One of the ways that you can certainly script Rudnitsky or cast him as a player on stage is as a Ukrainian nationalist. But that doesn't explain his knowledge of German, French, Russian. He wrote in German and Czech. He had debates with Polish geographers. In many ways, he picked up on the long intellectual history of German climatology, volcanology, meteorology, those sorts of things that virtually vanished during the geopolitical turns of the 1920s, much less the 2010s. So I try to be fair without offering hagiography or apologetics. I actually think I am quite fair to all of the prejudices held by people like Rudnitsky, for whom toward the end of his life, he didn't he didn't really have a city. Mm-hmm. He couldn't go back to Lemberg. Mm-hmm. He even couldn't go back to Ukraine. He was exiled to the Soviet hinterland after his arrest in 1933. The places also become signifiers of lost countries and all of the moods and all of I would say the emotions that emigres often have for places to which they can't return.
Mm-hmm. So there is a very insightful statement in your book. It's page 194. Places and maps are layered with meaning, and what you just described, I think, illustrates very well what is meant by this statement. Is your current project in any way connected with MapMan?
Well, thanks for the question. I love to plug current projects. I'm working on a couple of different ones, and I can describe what I'm doing in a moment. I'm really impressed by scholars who are microhistorians of a place. Mm-hmm. So the house on Ujazdovskaya Street, right down to the address, or the Dom na Naborozhnoye, the house of government. People who have actually zeroed in on an address. And I tried to do that with Romer because he had a house. It represented all of the bourgeois dreams of Poland on Ulica Dwugosza 25. It was in Soviet-occupied Lwów, Lemberg, Lviv. He had this house to which he could never return after 1941. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of Poles, of course, who lost their Polish Galicia, this is of course something which conjures all kinds of emotions and sometimes irrational politics. So as a way of describing my current projects, I'm working on three different things right now. One, I'm working on a transnational biography of the Ukrainian assassin Miroslav Sichinsky. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling the story of Sichinsky, who killed Count Potocki in Stanislavov in 1908, ended up escaping from prison and then into North America. He lived a very long life and died in Michigan in 1979. As for MapMan, my new project, one of them is a transnational history of airlines and aviation. So I'm interested in the mapping of airspace and the control of airspace and how airlines control or don't control this and how international law, especially since the 1940s, attempts to regulate it well into the Cold War. The closest project I have to MapMan is really not so much a book, but a gazetteer. Mm-hmm. And it is a gazetteer of fantasy places. The highbrow, or let's say high modernist fantasy places everybody knows, Kakania. But there are lowbrow places like Charlie Chaplin's Bacteria, right? Vaishnoria or San Marcos. These are all sort of, or Banderastadt, the sort of the nickname, right? These very colloquial nicknames that one begins to hear, Voroshilovgrad. I'm interested actually as a Ukrainist and a Ukrainian historian in the long history of fantasy maps and fictive maps. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. How, for instance, what happened, let's say, when a new country was invented by a slippage of the pen. The New York Times invented a new Kyrgyzstan, and it went viral. And on Wiki, there was a new history with maps of this fictional country that was created. Putin's Novorossiya, which of course is a fictional country, but does have a history going back to the imperial period and Catherine the Great, and at least through the early 19th century. How do those fictional countries circulate, gain sort of purchase? I've managed for this gazetteer, which I think will be a collaborative digital humanities project, to gather up the names of 500 different countries, different fictional countries, which were invented since the late 1880s and 1890s. you know, I mean, it comes out of Yiddish literature as well. The name for Kiev, people will sometimes forget, is Yehupetz, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, for Vilna, the Jerusalem of the north. There are plenty of places that I think are fictional, but gain more power just through circulating. And I think it's a very important exercise to understand how and why and where they're circulating and for what. So that is a project about place and space that I would say derives from MapMan.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, good luck on your projects, and I'm looking forward to your new publications and to your book, and I hope that we'll talk about your new books in the near future. Thank you so much for your book, for this excellent research, and thank you for guiding us through these labyrinths of map fantasy. Thank you so much, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Today I spoke with Stephen Siegel about his book MapMan, Transnational Lives and Deaths of Geographers in the Making of East Central Europe, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2018. Thank you for listening to the East European Studies podcast in the New Books Network.